Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Life can seem long, but it's not. One bad diagnosis, and it can get short in a hurry. Then what do you do? In their new movie, The Bucket List, when Jack Nicholson and Morgan Freeman's characters are told they have months to live, they make a list. Pretty soon, they're hunting lions, seeing the pyramids, getting tattooed, skydiving.
15 seconds!
No, wait! I can't do this!
Sure you can!
No! I can't! Really! No!
Ah! Let's hit the seals!
That's the Hollywood treatment. But in real life, people get the news every day. Life is probably going to be shorter than they thought. Then what? This hour On Point, making a bucket list for real. We have a remarkable panel with us today. Let me introduce them. Joining us from New York is Judy Friedman, a psychotherapist. In 2002, she was diagnosed with advanced lung cancer and told she had 6 to 10 months to live. She's now 59 and clearly with us. Welcome, Judy.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
We're very glad you're here. Also with us from New York, Chris Carr. In 2003, when she was 31 years old, she was diagnosed with a rare stage 4 sarcoma, a very tough cancer for which there is no treatment, no cure. She's 36 now and living large. She made a film documentary of her journey called Crazy Sexy Cancer and a book called Crazy Sexy Cancer Tips. Hi, Chris.
Hello there.
Great to have you with us. And it's good to have you. And from Chicago, Philip Crone joins us. In 2006, he was diagnosed with liver cancer and given 6 months to a year to live. He's 66, a political and urban affairs consultant. They thought he'd be gone by last October. He's not. He's an old friend. We've known each other for years. Hi, Phil. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good day.
Good day, sir. Good day, sir. Great to have you with us. All right. I don't know who's seen the movie. Judy, Chris, Phil. Has anybody seen it?
Ooh. I saw the movie.
Okay. Roger Ebert, the film critic who's had cancer of his own, as you know, in Chicago, Phil, he didn't like it. He said, the bucket list thinks dying of cancer is a laugh riot followed by a dime store epiphany. What'd you think, Phil?
Well, I thought it was at least worth a quarter. I cried at the end. And I don't normally cry. I don't think it's good for young people because they won't relate to it. But I enjoyed it very much. The only problem was I had done most of the things on the list or declined to do most of the things on the list. I have my own bucket list, and I expect to be here 6 months to a year for at least 6 more years at least.
I love it. You're already beating the odds on that, and we're very glad that you are. We'll hear more about that list and how you're whomping it. Judy Friedman, when you got the news in 2002, what was your first response? I mean, theirs was to, eventually to go out and, I don't know, clamber around the pyramids. How did you respond?
No, I didn't want to clamber around the pyramids. I was very frightened and very shocked, and I wanted to be very close to home and very close to people I loved. And then it sort of went on from there. I kind of wanted to feel safe and connected with people and feel close. And then little by little, as I kept being alive and kept feeling well, that's when I began to think of, what would I like to do?
As it stretched out beyond that 6 months, as it stretched out into
right.
something like free territory.
That's right. I thought, I can make this for 2 years. For some reason, I said to myself, they said 6 to 10 months. Well, I'll do it for 2 years. But then 2 years came and went. And actually, I had a sort of frightened feeling for a while. Like, now what do I do? I really have to keep living. So little by little, I put various things in place. And now my life really looks a lot different than it did before my diagnosis.
Chris, we'll get the top of your story. But let's listen here just for a second to one scene from The Bucket List. And here's Carter, played by Morgan Freeman, explaining to Edward, played by Jack Nicholson, where he, Carter, got the idea to come up with a list of all the things he wants to do before he dies.
My freshman philosophy professor assigned this exercise. He called it a bucket list. We were supposed to make a list of all the things we wanted to do in our lives before we
kicked the bucket.
Yeah.
Cutesy.
I was gonna redo the list, but then
help a complete stranger for the good. Laugh until I cry. Not to be judgmental, but this is extremely weak.
There's Jack Nicholson reading down Morgan Freeman's list, and he's not impressed. He's the rich guy. Morgan Freeman's the mechanic here. Chris Carr, where to begin? I mean, first of all, what about the whole idea? You didn't get a time span. You just got the news that you had a very, very tough cancer for which there was no cure. Did a bucket list ever occur to you? Or where did you begin to respond to that challenge as a 31-year-old?
Well, first and foremost, I think I was pretty frightened. At 31 years old, it's the last thing you expect.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I actually think that this film could be for young people. I think it's very important for people to start to realize that younger and younger folks are getting ill. And the main message, I think, of the film is to live your life. And so often we wait for retirement. We think we have all of our ducks in a row. We're going to start doing it post-college, post-paying for the debt, you know, getting that job. And to me, it's about doing it now. And in some ways, I think it was I never say the word gift, it's because for me, cancer was a catalyst, but it was a blessing to get it at a young age when I could say, okay, let's go. I was given different time spans by different people, depending on what doctor. And when I finally got to Dana-Farber is when I realized that this would be something that I more than likely could live my life with. And the bucket list, my form of the bucket list, was really about getting creative, helping people, starting to get active, doing the things that I always wanted to do as far as like writing and creativity. It definitely changed my life when I started to really live it.
Crazy Sexy Cancer was the name of the documentary that you went on to make, documenting your own sort of cancer odyssey. Let's listen to just a little.
Happy Valentine's Day. You have cancer.
There is no cure for the cancer I have. It's so rare. Everything is experimental.
I think this one's juicier.
My whole life has changed since then.
This is my liver.
Cancer, 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 cancer.
Chris Carr's documentary, Crazy Sexy Cancer. Phil Krohn, that's yours too, liver cancer, and you've licked the odds so far. I've known you for such a long time. You never leaned
over
30. Is it that long? My gosh.
Yeah, since you were a puppy.
I was a whelp. You never seemed to lean away from life. Did you find it really changed the way you did it, to know that it was going to be even shorter than you thought?
Well, I knew that sometime this part of your existence would be over. And I don't remember pre-existence, and I'm not sure there was any, but the Buddhists believe it. But I enjoy this life, and every day you have to balance discipline with spontaneity, and I think I've done well.
Tell us about what you've done with some of the time since the doctor gave you the news. I mean, it came down like a hammer. It changed you physically. You came to Boston last summer. We arranged to meet in Harvard Square. I've known you 37 years, you say, and you walked right up into my face before I recognized you. You had lost so much weight physically.
Yeah, got rid of my high blood pressure.
yeah, no doubt. And I don't know how many pounds as well. I mean, you're a lean machine now. What have you been doing with your not unlimited time, Mr. Krohn?
Well, I've decided to make a president of the United States. My bucket list is to be at Barack Obama's inauguration and, frankly, living long enough to be appointed ambassador of the United States to either New Zealand, Morocco, Czech Republic, or Slovakia.
Aim high, my friend. Aim high. I love it. What else is on there?
Well, I've been to the thing about the bucket, the movie, the list, I had seen the Taj Mahal and the pyramids and Hong Kong. And I saw Hong Kong with you, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, many years ago, yeah.
But not the first time. You've been to Hong Kong lots of times before.
Yeah.
But life is exciting, and my wife and son have handled it well. As I tell people, I'm not afraid of dying. I'm just not ready to go.
Yeah, so let's hang on, and let's hang on. Judy, did you find a community of people facing this kind of situation, or is it a solo undertaking?
No, I think it's a solo undertaking on one hand, that we're all, you know, alone in one sense. But on the other hand, there are people that we can gather around ourselves, some of whom are in similar situations. For example, I'm in a group at Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, where I do meet every other week with people who have very seriously advanced cancers, like myself. It's called Making Each Day Count, which in a way is kind of very consistent with the theme of this show. How do we live? How do we make each day count? And I have a very strong connection with those people. But I also have a very strong connection with my friends and my family, especially my husband and my daughter. We really, I think my expanded time allows me to be closer with my friends and family. I have more time to have lunch with them, to talk with them, to share with them. So I really do feel a strong sense of community. And the other way that I feel a sense of community is by reading. I haven't read Chris's book, but I would love to, and see your documentary. And
Sexy Cancer Tips.
Yeah, what an incredible title. And I've just read a lot of stories of survivors and people who've had dire illnesses and how they've managed their lives. And they've been really fascinating for me.
Judy Friedman. Yes, Phil.
I was just going to say, I'm going to be in New York between September 25th and 28th, so I want to meet these two gals.
Well, that'd be cool. Great.
I think the three of us should get together.
Hey, don't wait too long. Do not put it off.
Right. Don't put it off.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with three very real people given months to live or told there was no cure, about their own bucket lists and what they decided to do with the rest of their lives when that suddenly looked like it might be much closer than they had planned. I have been joined from New York, and very glad to be so, by Chris Carr. She's 36. 2003, she was diagnosed with a rare stage 4 sarcoma. There is no cure for it. She's a patient at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. She made a documentary about her personal journey called Crazy Sexy Cancer, and a book to go along with it, Crazy Sexy Cancer Tips. Judy Friedman, psychotherapist, got the news in 2002. 6 to 10 months to live. Advanced lung cancer. Now she's 59. She's with us as well today, and we're happy for that. Being treated at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. She's in the Cancer's Post-Treatment Resource Program there. Phil Crone joins us from Chicago, 66. Last October, I guess it was, Phil, was when you were supposed to be gone. That didn't happen. Is the doctor amazed? I know you flew him to Paris, and you guys went on a little weekend jaunt. Is that how you got him to keep you alive, Phil?
Yeah, and this year we're going to Morocco, his son and me and I. And I told him every year that I'm alive, we'll do a trip, because this is Chicago, and if you can't bribe your doctor, who can you bribe?
Whatever it takes. I love it. Let's go to Aurora. Lots of people want to join us. Let's go to Aurora, calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Aurora. You're on the air.
Hi there, Tom. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
You were missed. I just wanted to make the comment that three times I have been told to put my house in order, and I did my bucket list. And I am now sitting on the rim, if you want to say that.
How long were you told you had, Aurora?
Depending on which time, probably 2 years, 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
At the most, at the very last time, much less.
And how did you respond?
I responded by putting my house in order. And the first time, I did everything I could possibly want to ever do and travel. Bungee jump, say hello and goodbye to everybody. The second time, I took a little bit more time. The third time, it is a daunting task to reattach to the physical life.
To reattach after you've kind of made your peace and prepared to move on over.
Yes.
Hmm.
I think that people understand intellectually that this life is ephemeral, but to really have had your toes and probably all but maybe a piece of your heel over the edge is an experience that not many people can hear about without sort of getting confused.
And make it real for us. I can understand how it might be hard to reattach once you've begun to come to terms with it, but what kind of thing? I mean, do you never mind the taste of food anymore, or in concrete terms, Aurora?
The most concrete term would be that in social situations, when people are carrying on and spending a lot of time complaining out about bits of things that someone who's been ill considers a blessing.
Right.
It sort of flips the conversation, and you have to be patient and let them be in that place they are.
Yeah, Aurora, thanks. Chris Carr, what do you say to that? You've never been sort of given a date. In fact, yours has been the opposite, just sort of just a general threat out there, and here you are building a life right in the face of it, and quite vigorously. At the same time, it's made you think much earlier than most about, you know, about the great beyond. Aurora said she's almost had trouble coming back from that kind of contemplation.
I can understand that. I think that in our society, very few people really talk about and explore death. In fact, we more and more only explore the lives of people who are about 15 to 23 in the media. So it can be a real challenge. For me, one of the things that I did when I was first diagnosed is I moved into a Buddhist monastery for a summer, and I did a workshop called Being with Dying. And at the end of the workshop, though, I clawed and wanted to bite and run. I realized that the workshop was more about how to live. If all of these fears were melted away, how would I live my life? And instead of putting my affairs in order, which several people, you know, rightly recommended that I do, like get a will, et cetera, I was more rebellious and cavalier and decided to get a mortgage.
Okay, that's spitting in the wind.
I guess it was, but I just figured if this is going to be something that I might have to live with for the rest of my life, why am I going to put it on hold? And, I was diagnosed 5 years ago, and one of the hospitals I went to, I did go to five different hospitals. I think it's very important for patients to be advocates and find the best care. But in the beginning, I did go to one hospital here in New York that suggested that 10 years was max. So that would say that I have 5 years left. And I can't ever imagine that, and I don't actually think that way, but I don't think I'm in denial either.
Judy, you're a psychotherapist, and at least kind of hypothetically, you got closer than 5 years, though it turns out you didn't, but you had no way of knowing that. Aurora says it was hard to go there after a while. She did it three times and keep coming back sort of, you know, into the light.
Well, you know, I think that's very interesting what she says. I do think, though, that being on the cusp, she used a different term I don't remember exactly, but being
on the rim.
On the rim, right, right. I think you kind of have to simultaneously appreciate both if you possibly can. And the one kind of highlights the other, so that I do think that being in the moment of every of your life becomes even more intense. And even because you know that death can happen and that it's a real possibility for you. So I do think, though, even though it can be hard and you can sometimes try to even get yourself to imagine not being here anymore as a way of preparing yourself, but then the next day you're, you know, going to a party or you're making a special dinner or whatever. But those experiences can be even more vivified and intensified by knowing that they may end sooner than you would expect.
I want to ask each of you about relationships in the context of what you've faced. And here's a little bit that might get us going on it. Again, from the movie, The Bucket List. Here's a bit where Edward, this is Jack Nicholson's character, and he's a rich guy who can sort of finance all their bucket list adventures. And he and Carter, the Morgan Freeman character, decide to go off and live their list. That does not sit well with Carter's wife, who wants him to come home to the family. They have an angry confrontation in the hospital.
I think I've earned some time for myself.
To do what? Run off with a total stranger?
He's not a stranger.
I'm your wife.
And I'm your husband. And I'm their father. And I'm a grandfather. And I'm a damn mechanic.
And you're a fool. You're a fool who thinks he's figured out a way how not to have cancer.
There you go, from the bucket list. Judy Friedman, this kind of diagnosis falls into the middle of real life, not into some hypothetical paradise. What about relationships? How did it come into yours in those terms?
Yeah, that's so important. I empathize with the wife and with the guy. But, I have a longstanding relationship with my husband now of 27 years. And actually, we were not in such great shape with each other prior to my diagnosis. And I would say that during the course of time that I've been ill, we've been able to come closer and closer together and do a lot of things together. you know, we, for example, traveled to Europe 3 times in a year and a half where we had never traveled out of the country before and had a wonderful time. And I think that those are one of many kinds of things that we did that did bring us closer. I think the fact of the possibility of my death made us value each other more. But I can also understand that, you know, sometimes people want to have, and so do I have other very strong relationships with friends, with my daughter, also with a 3-year-old boy who lives down the hall. And, you know, we also want to explore relationships and get outside of ourselves and outside of our normal, let's say, kind of relationship routines. But for me, I have to say that the closest relationships have become even closer, and I value that. I think that's very important. And I think having,
Phil,
I also wanted to say,
please.
Oh, sorry.
Please, Judy.
I think relationships with your, I want to make sure I say this, that having a relationship with your doctor is very important. At least it has been for me. And I know you mentioned that I was at Memorial Sloan Kettering, which is true. But like Chris, I too have been at many different hospitals, and I think it's very important. And actually, my home base hospital is NYU Medical Center, and my doctor there is Abraham Shishua, and I want to mention him because he has been really a spectacular, humanistic, very connected person in my life, and he has really helped me be courageous and feel that I'm not just alone with this. In many ways, it would be hard to really explain, and I just want to emphasize that relationship has been absolutely critical for me.
Phil Crone, how about yourself? Relationships from family to friends to, for that matter, your doctor.
Well, first of all, I have 4 wonderful doctors, James Madura, Steve Jensik, Forrest Dodson, and Steve Rothschild. I have better care than any emperor or king had in the 19th or 18th centuries. And as well as we should be grateful for, with all the complaints that we have about modern society and the terrible aspects of the 20th century horrors, we still have central heating, flush toilets, all sorts of wonderful things that monarchs did not have in previous centuries. But I'm very grateful for the warning, so to speak, because it made me value and be grateful for everything I did have, intensified relationships. At some point, I almost felt like I should apologize for lasting longer than my sell-by, use-by dates. But people have adjusted to what I say, the Sophie Tucker method, which is I'm now on my 2nd farewell tour, and I hope to have 14 of them like Sophie did. Every year she'd come in and say, well, this might be my last time, children.
I love that.
With all her rhinestones.
We caught up last summer, last July 4th, when you were on one of your farewell tours, a wonderfully grand one. Remind us what you were up to then.
Well,
talk about a bucket list.
It was a dry run for Barack Obama because I thought that next 4th of July, he should be going to the homes and graves of our first 6 presidents, Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, and Adams. And you can do 2 Adams for the price of 1, which you and I did, and you had never been there before. And we were the first people to show up at the house and the grave at 9 a.m. on July 4th. And it was an inspiring experience.
It was.
It was more inspiring because I was with you, my young friend, who I still remember that picture of you with your arm around your 4-H sheep down in Normal, Illinois,
right.
The freshly sheared sheep, and your new crew cut. You looked like you were clones
of each other. We were twins. Hey, I won the sheep shearing contest. It was I made my bucket list just getting started. Let's go to Robert in Stowe, Vermont. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you know?
What do I know? About a year and a half ago, I was diagnosed with a fairly obscure form of cancer called myelodysplastic syndrome. It's a cancer of the bone marrow. And they found it completely by accident. They weren't looking for it. I was seeing somebody else for something, and when they tested my bone marrow, they dropped this on me. The thing is that it's asymptomatic right now, meaning that the disease is there. They know it's there, but it's, the only thing it shows is a mild form of anemia. And what they can't tell me is, when it will become active, and then once it's active, what my prognosis is.
But you know it's there, and how has it changed the way you live, see the world, Robert? What?
Yeah, it has. I went, for the first month or so, went through all the stages of why me and the denial and the and the tears and so forth. I'm 58 years old. One of the main treatments for it is, if it was active, it would be a bone marrow transplant. But they usually don't do that after age 60. So by the time I'm 60, if it, nothing's happened, then my treatments are whatever new treatment's going to be available at that time.
So have you gone off to Bora Bora or
I'm heading there. I've decided that after, you know, 27 years of living up here in Vermont, that my body could use some total immersion in warm, salty water, and I'm heading south fairly soon. And I'll try living down, you know, in Key West for a while, and then if I don't like that, you know, I'll move on to someplace else. My daughter is about to go to college. I'm separated and divorcing my wife. This whole thing was hard on both of us. I think in some ways, you know, people were just talking about relationships and so forth. With me, I've kind of put it out of my mind a little bit, but it comes back in every 3 months because I get my blood tested.
Yep.
And then they send it down to Boston to Dana-Farber, and then I wait a week in tenseness, and then they tell me nothing's changed, keep on going. You know, and so every 3 months I've got to think about it again. So I kind of just let it get to the back of my mind. My wife, on the other hand, was getting very, I won't say obsessed with this whole idea of how she was going to be my primary caregiver when yeah. I'm hospitalized and feebleized yeah. and so forth. And yeah. and that was tough on both of us. And that's one of the reasons why we ended up splitting up. But I think what I want to do now is just take what time I have left, however long it is, and go to places I haven't gone to, do things I haven't done. Not extravagant things, but just, you know, while I can do it, while I can afford to do it, and while I'm alive to do it.
Robert, we hear you headed out on your list, and we wish you the most fulfilling time you can possibly have there. Chris Carr, you came into this at a younger age than Judy or Philip, and probably it sounds like Robert as well. What about relationships when this kind of thing, you know, drops on you when you were 31?
Yeah, well, I have a really interesting story, actually, about that, because I actually met my husband through my diagnosis.
How?
Well, he was the editor and the producer of the film, so we spent 4 years making this project, and after about a year and a half, we fell in love, and we got married a year ago.
Congratulations. That's great.
It's really exciting. We just had our first anniversary, and but I will say that I have lost friends as a result of it, and it might sound trite, but sometimes I say that cancer is a great way to renovate your black book, because you got to trim the fat. You know, there's a lot of people in your life, and the people who aren't really going to be there and support you, I think, are energy drains, and I support, you know, anybody who really needs to simplify, or, for example, divorce comes along, be it unfortunate and often painful, the rest of your life is something that's very precious. Mm-hmm. And to surround yourself with people who respect that and honor you is, I think, vital. But also, as far as doctors go, I have a really amazing doctor at Dana-Farber, Dr. George Dimitri. And one of the things I have to say I love so much is that not only is he the best doctor for my disease, but he's a good friend.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking today with three very real people given months to live or told there was no cure about their own bucket lists and what they decided to do with the rest of their lives when that suddenly looked like it might be a lot shorter than they had planned. In New York, Judy Friedman joins us. In 2002, she was diagnosed with advanced lung cancer, given 6 to 10 months to live. She's clearly beaten those odds. Chris Carr is with us from New York. She's 36 now. When she was 31, she was diagnosed with a rare stage 4 sarcoma. There's no treatment, really, no cure. She had to face that. She's still here. Philip Krohn is with us from Chicago. He's 66 now, married, one child. In 2005, was diagnosed with gallbladder cancer. Then 2006 came a diagnosis of liver cancer. He was given 6 months to a year to live last October. He thought might be the end. It wasn't. He's still around. In the movie The Bucket List, it's kind of all uplifting. There's a new series on the cable channel AMC called Breaking Bad. It's a bit different. It's got a dark look at how you might respond to a terminal diagnosis or wanted. Here, high school chemistry teacher Walter White is diagnosed with lung cancer, concerned about his family's financial future, uses his science know-how to make or try to make a quick buck by turning an RV into a rolling methamphetamine lab. In this scene, he approaches a former student, a dropout, a drug dealer, about teaming up in the meth business.
You know the business, and I know the chemistry. I'm thinking maybe you and I could partner up.
You want to cook crystal meth? You and me.
That's right. Either that, or I turn you in.
Okay. There's the dark side. Anything to make a cable series, but I don't know. Judy, Phil, I mean, Chris, for that matter, did you ever... I guess you're given a kind of freedom at the same time that you're given a short, leash when you get this kind of diagnosis. Were you ever tempted to the dark side?
No. I mean, the dark side. No, I don't think I'd have the imagination to think of something like that. The dark side for me would more mean becoming mournful and miserable and self-pitying.
Yeah.
And I've definitely been at that sort of dark side. That's an interesting segment you just played. I wouldn't think of that. I don't know. Let's hear from somebody.
Phil, how about yourself? Did you ever decide to become the Pink Panther, go out and rob banks and steal jewels on your short clock?
No, I'm too excited about doing the good things.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, I have a literary agent, the same agent that represents Lady Antonia Fraser and represented C.P. Snow Curtis Brown. The two working titles of my books are one, Phil Krohn Died Tomorrow, and that's based on the idea that if I were in Australia right now and I died in Australia, you could accurately say, we're sorry to report, we just heard that Phil Krohn died tomorrow.
Okay. And you might be in Australia with your travel habits.
I could be, sure.
Mr. Peripatetic.
And the other title is How to Prolong Your Life by Making Dying Fun. And I've had so much fun that I haven't had time to write much.
Crazy Sexy Cancer.
Exactly. And I happen to, as you know, have been a Christian Scientist.
Yeah.
And while I've used medical attention, because this is the year 2007 and not 1887, now I only have Christian Science, and it's very useful. Mary Baker Eddy has wonderful guidelines for me to make my life stronger. I also pray to my tumor. I say, tumor, you're the parasite, I'm the host. If I die, you die. So don't munch too vigorously, and we'll both last a long time.
Oh, jeez. Chris, what do you say?
Well, I have to agree with everybody. I never thought about doing sort of dark crystal meth kind of
stoke
things,
the lab.
I think in many cases it's more dangerous to truly live and do positive things. Mm-hmm. And I feel much more alive doing those things and actually trying to make a difference in the world and uplift people's lives, the lives of people around me, lives of people who are a part of my cancer community, and I prefer the light.
Judy, have you found that you've had time? You mentioned reading. I can imagine a kind of a cross current here. On the one hand, the end is nigh. Let's get philosophical. Read deeply. Pack on wisdom. On the other hand, time is short. Yeah. Let's go out and run in the daisies.
I don't think they're mutually exclusive, though. Mm-hmm. I think that I do love reading. That's a great love of mine. And actually, one of the things that I've also been able to do is join some really interesting reading groups. One of them is a mother-daughter reading group. And we read great, wonderful literature, and we talk about it. And that's just been a great passion. Mm. But I also run out in the daisies. And, you can have different kinds of passions and excitements. And some of them can be sort of interior and philosophical. philosophical and thoughtful, and some of them can be out there swimming in the water. I love water. I love to be in the ocean. You know, as I said, I loved the traveling that we did.
Yeah.
And I love photography also. One of the things I began to do is go out in the streets, and I always liked photography, but I got a digital camera and started taking pictures, and sort of the moments of the pictures meant so much to me because those are real moments of real life. And then I began turning them into cards and making cards out of them, and I'm actually thinking of marketing some of them. So, you know, all of those things, they're not necessarily mutually exclusive kinds of things. One thing you said earlier, though, about when you went to the dark side point was the idea that you are given more freedom. And I think that is very true. And one of the ways that I was given more freedom is I didn't have to work in the way that I had worked. And it wasn't that I didn't love my work, because I did. I was, as I said, a psychotherapist. But I didn't like to work as much as I was working.
And you didn't have to financially? It was.
And that's very lucky, that because my husband makes enough money. Mm-hmm. We're certainly not rich. Mm-hmm. And he has, thank goodness, health insurance. Mm-hmm. I was able, my doctor actually said, stop working. He said, stop working, you know, 6 to 10 months, stop working. And also, it's not fair to patients if you're seeing them on a long-term basis, if you might die on them.
To your patients, when you were a therapist, right, you might go away.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And some people become very, and need to be very dependent upon you for periods of time. So I did have to refer all of my patients to other therapists. And then I had much, much more time. I did transform my practice. And now what I do is I have a referral service where I make matches between patients and therapists. So somebody comes to me looking for a therapist, and I will find them a therapist who will work well with them. And I also do short-term and crisis intervention work.
Work that fits your circumstances and a kind of freedom there on the rim, as our earlier caller described it. We've got so many callers.
Right.
Let's go to North Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and Ron. Ron, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. My story is that my wife was diagnosed in 1994 with stage 4B sarcoma, leiomyosarcoma. It's a soft tissue cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And
Chris Carr's alley. Yep.
Beg pardon?
It's in Chris Carr's neck of the woods, yes.
Yeah. She worked as a medical technologist in a local hospital, and was told by the oncologist that she probably wasn't going to get any successful treatment. She didn't want to stay at the local hospital. She knew enough to go to a cancer center. And we tried a few. We went to Dana-Farber. We went to Sloan Kettering and stayed at Sloan Kettering because the surgeon was the perfect guy for the job. She spent 9 months in intensive treatment with pre-surgical treatments.
Yes.
And had a massive surgery and post-surgical chemo. And her life was changed by the cancer. She tried to go back to work for a while, but it didn't work very well. She had been devastated by the whole treatment thing. So we started to travel. We went to California a few times. She loved to hike. We did that. But her health wasn't it was unsteady, and eventually cancer came back. And, of course, it affects your bucket list, I think.
Ron, you're speaking of her in the past tense. Did she finally succumb to the sarcoma?
She lived for 10 years. She passed away in 2004 because the cancer came back and eventually spread to the point where it couldn't be treated. It couldn't be treated because it was all over her, around her spine and
right.
Too many places to do surgery. Radiation didn't work. Chemo couldn't work anymore because it couldn't be invasive enough.
So you traveled, you lived. How did your relationship, sustain in that time, Ron?
We had met and married 5 years before her diagnosis. We had a great relationship then. During the whole treatment, we lived together in the hospital to the extent that we could. We traveled. We loved each other very much, and it didn't suffer. It was maybe enhanced even by the illness.
Chris Carr, I wonder how you're taking this story on board. After all, this is, it sounds to my layman's ear, your cancer. What may have been your time frame?
Everybody's different, you know.
We've all got a time frame.
Has the same story, and we're all going to die. The question to me is how many of us are really going to commit to living, which is about what this conversation is about. And, you know, there have been times when let me tell you that sarcomas affect less than 1% of the cancer population, and the cancer that I have affects less than 1% of the sarcoma population. So it's incredibly rare, and I've heard other stories of patients with my disease, which is epithelioid hemangioendothelioma. Say that three times fast.
Good luck. Right.
You know, that haven't had the best prognosis, or, you know, maybe haven't been able to stable the disease the way I have. And I can't really let that affect my path or put me into a state of fear, because I think that when you're in the fear state, you stop living your life and you curl up.
But it is, you know, absolutely, and we're for that. And as you say, in a way, the whole conversation, this is a natural impulse, is to say, you know, you go, girl, you go, guy, live. At the same time, you're facing kind of the ultimate that humans don't face, readily or often willingly. And I know from your documentary, Chris, it is not always easy and not always gung-ho. There is the tough time of facing that as well.
Of course, there's a tough time. But you know,
I don't
what?
Find
I think...
it tough.
Honestly, sorry. Phil, really, you honestly, really, truly do not.
I haven't lost literally a minute of sleep. I haven't had a nightmare. my relationship with my wonderful wife, Joan Powell, who's running for judge here in Cook County. I know this program doesn't run here, but she was appointed a judge a year ago by the Supreme Court. Now she's running for it, and that's a lot of fun. My son is having his first one-man show in America in Los Angeles, February 23rd, and the next day we celebrate. He calls it his crucifixion birthday. He's going to be 33. And we've gotten closer. He's a great son. She's a great wife. And I love my mother-in-law, and I travel with her a lot. People say, why do you travel with your mother-in-law? I said, well, it's a way to make life seem longer. She has a good sense of humor. She doesn't mind.
I hope so. Well, I mean, you're 66, so what's your attitude? It's maybe less than I'd hope.
First of all, I'm a 19-year-old in a 66-year-old body,
yeah,
but I'm 19. I haven't reached a level of maturity yet.
Yeah. Judy, how about your bright days versus tough days? What's the balance been, and how do you get through when they're not so easy?
Yeah, I think there are. For me, there's certainly been hard days. And, you know, I think for most people, and Phil, you're lucky if you don't feel them, but I think most of us are going to feel sad or angry or scared. And I think... You know, as Chris said, you don't want to get locked into fear, and you try to work with that. You try to work with, you know, you try to get through that. But you feel it, and you have to let yourself feel it and accept that you feel it and then get past it. And I wouldn't want people to think that they were, you know, bad cancer patients if they weren't happy all the time, because, you know, let's face it, most of us are going to feel bad sometimes about this, and sometimes very bad.
Yeah.
And I think also it can depend on how you feel physically. You know,
sure.
If you're feeling pretty well, and I think the three of us seem to be feeling pretty well, but there are times when I haven't felt so well because of chemotherapy or my cough has been pretty bad or something, that can affect your mental state.
Yeah, Roger Ebert wrote in his review of the bucket list, he said, you know, sometimes your list is more likely just to have at the top of it keeping down a full meal or keeping your energy up in the afternoon. Let's get one more call from Northampton, Massachusetts. Basha. Hi, Basha. You're on the air.
I am a NPR junkie. I'm really indebted to you people, all of you.
Well, we're glad to have you. What do you know on this front, Basha?
Well, last time I spoke to you, it was about women's breast cancer. And at the time, I didn't know I was a cancer person myself.
You've had a diagnosis since the time you last called in. What have you found out?
Yeah, on 10th of November, I learned I have a huge cancer on my stomach, gastric cancer. And... I am grateful. I am writing a song right now, nowadays, that I am, oh, cancer, I'm so grateful to you. You made me to be grateful to the police and hospital, because police found me and hospital gave me life.
You got the diagnosis and you wrote a song about it. It seems like you're handling it okay, Basha. Have they told you, what's your prognosis?
Yeah, well, I'm loving your guests. It's so beautiful, particularly the person who is 19. It's one of the greatest numbers. I'm writing something about that too. Number 19 is the most important number.
Basha,
so it's really, really beautiful.
Our time is short, but we appreciate the light that comes along with your tough news there. And Phil Krohn, you've got maybe a fellow traveler in Basha. He's got his diagnosis and he's made it into a song first thing.
Yeah, well, I don't want to make light, and I think the ladies are right that you do have tough days where you're feeling really horrible. So I go to sleep, or I take a hydrocodone. I don't mind dying, but I don't want any pain, no suffocation, no choking or coughing. Those are the things I don't want. But I'm having a really terrific time enjoying things with a greater intensity. When they ring the bell and tell you, you know, your time is up, and it's wonderful every time it's not up. So I say, well, how about the 6 months to a year with renewable options?
With renewable options.
Yeah.
Phil, you know, our friendship has meant a lot to me for many years, and I'm glad that it just keeps to get going here. My own kids are paying attention to your story and learning something from it, and I'm sure that many others will learn something important today. Chris Carr and Judy Friedman from your stories as well. I want to thank all of you for being with us. Phil, thank you so much for joining us from Chicago.
And thank you, but I want to say thank you to Mary Gaffney, who's my personal producer here today at WBZ in Chicago, and they should carry this program.
Thanks to all. Chris Carr and Judy Friedman in New York, thanks, and good luck to both of you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Listeners, thank you for being with us. Live long and prosper. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Walking like